the things I always remind myself is at NIH, at the National Institute of Health, we use acronyms a lot for what we do. So please put up your hand if I use an acronym that you're not familiar with. We have a lot of abbreviations that we use, and sometimes we just kind of slip into that speak, and I kind of forget about that. So today, what I'm going to be focusing on are the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, our priorities and funding opportunities, and specifically related to public health is kind of the goal that I'm going to take today. So let's see. There we go. So disclosure, I am an employee of the federal government. I work for DHHS, specifically the National Institutes of Health, and my center is the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. The views I'm expressing today are my own, although the general information is all available for the most part on our website, and I have no other financial interests. So just to give you an overview of where I'm headed today, I'm going to give you a very brief kind of intro to NIH, a couple of things that I didn't know about NIH before I joined them about a year and a half ago, give you a little bit of information about, I think you're all in this room because you're interested in complementary and alternative medicine, and I'm going to give you a couple examples of why this type of medicine and more research is needed, because I think it can have a large impact on public health. The National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine over the last year has been going through a strategic planning process for our third strategic plan, and I'm going to share with you some of the draft strategic plan new objectives and new goals that we have outlined, which I think overlay quite a bit with public health interests in terms of healthy behaviors. I'm curious, how many people in the room have submitted a grant since January of 2010 to the National Institute of Health in the room? Okay. Few of you have, so you're aware of all of the major changes that have gone on in the last few months. So I'm going to go over those just briefly to highlight those, that there have been major changes to the entire review process, including the applications at NIH. And then I'm going to wrap up with some of the funding opportunities that we have currently available at NCAM, and focusing on the ones that I think would be of interest to those of you that are in the field of public health. All right. So NIH is a group of 27 different institutes and centers, as well as a number of different offices. And the goal at NIH is science in pursuit of the fundamental knowledge about nature and behavior of living systems. And what makes us different from the National Science Foundation is that it's then the application of that knowledge to extend healthy life and reduce the burdens of illness and disability. And so that's really kind of the focus at the National Institutes of Health. This is something that I was not completely aware of. NIH in the Bethesda campus is on 322 acres, and there are 75 different buildings there. The building you see down here in the bottom is the clinical center. That is the largest clinical research facility in the world. Everyone who's seen as a patient in that facility is seen on a clinical research protocol. And it is just an enormous and amazing facility where the scientists who do what we call intramural research at NIH, they do their research on the campus at NIH, do their work there at the clinical center in fields from all of the different institutes and centers across NIH. This is our website for NCAM, and there's a wealth of both public information, information for researchers, information for people who just want general knowledge about complementary and alternative medicine. And I'm going to put a plug in. We, as well as many of the NIH institutes and centers, have a booth over at the expo in NIH row there, where you can get a lot of our materials and get information about how you can actually order materials to distribute to your patients or the people that you see in your community settings. There's a great deal of information on here from health information, as I mentioned, and each of the different drop-down tabs at the top kind of lead you to different places, whether you want information on health information, whether you want information on what research we've funded and what the results of that research are, whether you want to know about grant and funding opportunities, training opportunities, all of those are available through our website. So this is NCAM's current mission, and it's threefold. And so the idea is to use rigorous science to study the safety and efficacy of CAM approaches, to support the development of trained researchers, as well as to disseminate authoritative information. That's one of the aspects that's part of our legislative mandate that we need to do as part of our role at NCAM, is to make sure that there's authoritative information available to the public. This mission, there's in the strategic plan, we're, as I mentioned, in the middle of right now, the mission is proposed to actually change a little bit. And so this is the new mission that's being proposed to define through rigorous scientific investigation the usefulness and safety of CAM interventions and their roles in improving health and healthcare. So making it a little bit more concise and not such a long mission statement. So some of you who've been at the sessions earlier kind of throughout the day have maybe heard some of this data already, but the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine includes both in 2007 and in 2002 a supplement to the National Health Interview Survey to specifically look at complementary and alternative medicine use. And this data comes from the 2007 CAM supplement, where we found 40% of Americans had used some form of CAM therapies in the last 12 months. That's not lifetime prevalence of use, that's the last 12 months. And that's quite consistent with previous surveys. What people use does change a little bit over time, but that seems to be a fairly stable estimate. Widespread use across all different demographic groups, although women do use CAM more than men, and there's highest use in the West, with the least amount in the South. Most of this is paid for out of pocket, although more and more insurance companies are covering CAM therapies. The estimated out of cost expenditure per year are $34 billion out of pocket, which is only 1% of all healthcare expenditures, but it's 10% of out of pocket if you don't include the insurance there. So, and one of the things that is consistent is that you see the highest use among those with higher levels of education. Just to give you a couple examples here of what actually is being used, this data is all published in a report that was done by one of my colleagues, Dr. Barnes, and published in December of 2008. This is, you can find this link on our website. Highest use of CAM products are for natural products, followed by deep breathing, meditation, chiropractic, osteopathic, massage, and yoga. And where we saw the biggest change from 2002 to 2007, we saw the biggest increases in deep breathing, meditation, massage, and yoga. And Dr. Briggs likes to, who's the director of the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, likes to call these main street forms of CAM therapies. You see these now all the time as you walk down the street. You see massage therapists, you see meditation practices, and you see yoga studios. And so we're seeing those more and more integrated into the public use all the time. Why are people using complementary and alternative medicine? The data is quite consistent that pain seems to be one of the number one reasons that people report using complementary and alternative medicine when they use it for a specific condition. So about half of all uses for to treat a medical condition like back pain or neck pain or joint pain. The other half of use is for wellness or prevention. And that's something that we learned in the 2007 NHIS data is this new kind of something that we hadn't really known as much before, that about half of Americans report the reason that they're using a natural product or using these CAM therapies are to improve their overall wellness or for what they call prevention. And so that's an area where we're now quite interested to learn a little bit more about what that use is and what are the benefits that people are seeing from the use of CAM. Just to give you an example of a recently published paper, the New England Journal of Medicine recently published a study of one of our researchers looking at a randomized trial of Tai Chi for fibromyalgia that showed very good benefit for fibromyalgia in these patients. And there was a really great, kind of fun, a little bit tongue-in-cheek editorial that went along with it by Gloria Yeh. And for those of you who know Ted Kapchuk, that fits right along with who Ted is. And one of the comments they had in there is, you know, what should our sham control be for Tai Chi? Should it be, I think, an uncaring, you know, non-intended movement? He has a really great quote in there about how do we control for these interventions? What would be the opposite of Tai Chi? How do you, you know, control for all of those aspects? So I encourage you to take a look at that. One of the things we do at NCAM is kind of track what is all of the media attention that these studies get. This is an example from the New York Times. There was an article on massage, and it was the most popular emailed article for that day on the New York Times. So this type of research gets a lot of media attention, and we're seeing a little bit of anecdotal evidence to show that possibly what we're doing, we're actually seeing quite a bit of uptake by the public, and I'll give you a couple examples of that. So many of you are probably aware that the FDA has really cracked down on a lot of the muscle-building products and has been testing a lot of those products and finding steroids and steroid-like substances, analogs, in those products and issuing warnings and sending letters to those manufacturers that those products need to be pulled from the market because they actually have drugs in them and they're not approved for use in the United States. So that's a huge campaign that's kind of going on right now, and we're trying to make the FDA is doing a lot of looking to make sure what's in the public market is safe and that we know what's in products. The FDA is the regulatory side. The NCAM is not involved in those activities. That's part of what the FDA is responsible for. However, we do sometimes fund research that may lead to policy implications or different pieces. This is a piece of work from one of our researchers, Rob Safer, who was funded to take a look at the amount of lead, mercury, and arsenic in Indian manufactured Ayurvedic products that were available over the internet. And so he did a random sample of all of these products that were available and had them analyzed for their lead, mercury, and arsenic content. And the different lines here, the line to the far left is the California level, the middle line is the ANSI level, and then the FAO and the WHO level is the one to the far right. And you can see the number of products here that fell had higher than the daily amount of lead that were recommended in terms of intake. And this is a study that we fund. We don't do the policy implications of this, but what this led to was the FDA came out with a warning to really, you know, let people know that there may be heavy metals in some of these products and that we really need to take a look and make sure that what people are getting and what's available over the internet or over the counter is really safe. And so that's kind of a result of some of the work that we funded. The natural product industry also tracks what we do, and this is an example that was published in the Nutrition Business Journal that shows changes in echinacea sales from 2004 to 2005. So the clear bars are 2004 sales data, and the 2005 are in the dark bars there. And there was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine that NCAM funded that was published in July of 2005, and you can see the drop-off in echinacea sales. The study found that echinacea was not beneficial for preventing a rhinovirus infection in a rhinovirus challenge model is what they did with three different forms of echinacea that they looked at. They didn't see any change in the amount of infection that occurred. So I'm going to wrap there, and hopefully I've given you a little bit of a flavor of how much the kind of variety of projects that we fund and potentially what the public health impact can be in terms of the heavy metals that may be in some of these products, the impact in terms of use, and clearly with 40% of Americans using some form of CAM therapies, we need to know more about what works, what is safe, and once we find out what works, how do we then integrate it and actually get it into public use? We're seeing public use quite common, but we need to get a better indication of what works and so that we know what to really encourage. So next I'm going to go and talk a little bit about the NCAM strategic plan and kind of where we're headed in the next 5 years. And this is still in the draft form. This was up and available for public comment in September. And the final version will be, we hope, published in February 2011, but sometime this spring is what we're hoping for. This is going to be a very different type of strategic plan for NCAM. In the past, NCAM strategic plans have included a lot of kind of what are the options, what are the opportunities, what are the wide range of areas that we could do research in. And this is a very different type of strategic plan that's much more strategic in terms of how are we going to make decisions, what are our priorities, where are we going to focus, and how do we build collaboration and build capacity for research in the field. And so this will not be an exhaustive list of all of the different areas in complementary and alternative medicine that we could go into. Instead, it'll be really focused on how are we going to prioritize and how do we move the field forward. As I mentioned, we've already had the draft up for public comment, and the public comment period has closed, and we're hoping to have that published quite soon. So this strategic plan was developed under our advisory council, who Adam is a member of our advisory council. We really worked hard and under the advisory council and our director, Dr. Briggs, and our deputy director, Dr. Killen, to make this a really science and data-driven type of project. So where is the most promise? And we really tried to make it an open and transparent type of process as well. So a lot of opportunities for public comment and for input from the field and getting communication from all of the different stakeholders involved in our those that are interested in our mission. So these are the draft goals for the third strategic plan. There may be some slight changes to this as the final document is being kind of worked on at this time. But I think you'll see that this is kind of moving us in a slightly different direction. So one of the things that we want to do is advance the science and practice of symptom management related to complementary and alternative medicine. Part of that is in the area of pain research, with so many people using complementary and alternative medicine for pain as a management of that type of symptom. It makes sense that we would investigate what therapies are beneficial for that type of symptom management. Also to look at effective, practical, personalized strategies for promoting health and well-being. This idea of people using CAM therapies for wellness and for prevention, we need to get a better understanding of what does that mean. And we'll have to figure out the best ways to do that type of research. And I'll give you an example in just a minute. So we want to enable better evidence-based decision-making regarding CAM use and its integration into health and health promotion. So that's, as we build the evidence base and do more research and more studies in these areas, we'll be able to make better evidence-based decisions. And that'll hopefully influence in the long run what gets integrated into healthcare and what may be beneficial for health promotion. The draft strategic objectives, so this is where you get an idea of some of the areas that we will probably be focusing on. So mind-body interventions, practices, and disciplines. We have, I'll give you some examples of some funding opportunities available, but definitely in the area for mind-body therapies, we've funded quite a bit of research looking at acupuncture for pain, looking at spinal manipulative therapies for pain, looking at the mechanisms of how do those therapies work and why are they working the way they are. Specifically related to natural products, we want a better understanding of the mechanisms of how these work. And as we move into clinical trials, having a much better idea of what the biological signature or what is it impacting. How, do we have a measure that whatever it is that the person is taking has a biological effect so that we can see that in the clinical trials as we move through? I think as we look in the healthcare and health promotion, where we see this really going initially is because there hasn't been as much research in this area, we probably need to start with some effectiveness research or some observational types of studies to get a real sense of what's actually being used and what are the outcomes that we're seeing at kind of the real world use in terms of healthcare and health promotion and that idea of wellness. Always part of the mission of NIH is to improve the capacity for research. We always talk about training the next generation of researchers, so training will continue to be part of our portfolio. And as part of our mandate, it's very important that we disseminate the findings of the research that we fund and that we provide evidence-based information. So we will continue to have a very active website and try to figure out innovative ways to get that information out to the public. So this I'm going to do very briefly, and all of this information is available up on our website. So please, if you have specific questions, let me know. But this is a little bit of the nuts and bolts of applying for a grant and what's changed in the last couple of years. The whole idea, there was a project that was taken on called Enhancing Peer Review, and the idea was to really change the way the applications came in and the review was done at NIH. And they wanted to encourage, there's always been this goal to get researchers funded earlier in their career, and so to fund new investigators early. To ease the burden, for those of you who've submitted grant applications, it is a lot of work, it's a lot of paperwork. If you're applying for center grants, which have multiple projects and multiple cores, it is just, you know, they can be 1,000 pages, those applications. I mean, they're just enormous. And so the goal is to kind of ease the burden on the research enterprise. And part of that's our reviewers too. I mean, if you're on one of our review panels and you have 8 applications assigned to you and they're all 300 pages long, it's a lot of work that you're taking on and trying to do that. So we're also trying to streamline the time to award so that things can move a little bit faster. We all got a crash course in that with the Recovery Act and the stimulus funding that came through. We learned how quickly and we can do review and fund studies, but I'm not sure that any of us really want to do that again in the near future, that's for sure. ultimate goal is to fund the best science by the best scientists with the least amount of administrative burden. That was really the whole purpose of this idea. So these are some of the changes that occurred. And so there was, they kind of phased it in different approaches. And so the first phase was in January of 2009, where they took away the third application. So now each individual application has two chances, an original submission and one resubmission in A1. They implemented this identification of people who are what they call early stage investigators. You're within 10 years of receiving your terminal degree, and that's how you're qualified. And many of the institutes and centers give a little bit of a break on their pay line. Pay line is kind of how far do we go down, how far do we fund, how many applications can we fund. And so they'll give a little bit more of a cushion and fund earlier scientists a little bit farther along. And then the next phase was changing the review process. So the review summary statements are completely different. I'm going to give you an example of the scoring criterion and how things are done. They've changed the order in which things are reviewed. They've tried to cluster the applications together. And then most recently, as I asked ENDS who submitted after January 2010, because that's when the recent, the last phase of this level of change, where the restructured application is, and I'm going to give you the new shorter page limits here in just a second. So this is the new scoring criteria. When you submit a grant now to the NIH, these are the different areas. For the most part, all grants get reviewed on these areas. There's always exceptions, I've learned, to the grants, but significance, the investigators, the innovation, the approach, and the environment. And each one of those, for your primary reviewers, you'll be scored on individually. So you'll get a score from each reviewer for significance, investigator, innovation, approach, and environment. So the idea is then you have a better sense when you get your score back, well, what area do they feel like I need to improve? Is it my significance? Is it the innovation? Is it the approach that the design I put together they had some problems with? So, and it's rated on a 1 to 9 scale. This is kind of a little bit of a descriptor of the 1 to 9 scale. This is actually the scale that's used in terms of grading the overall impact. So when your grant application comes in, it gets assigned to a number of primary reviewers. They go through and score each criterion. And then if it comes up for discussion, everyone at the review table, which is often 30 or 40 people, gives an overall impact score. What do they think is the overall quality? And they're looking for different types of descriptors here that help them give an idea. And the challenge that we have at NIH is we have so many amazing proposals. And as you'll see, you know, our descriptors are exceptional, outstanding, excellent, very good, good, satisfactory. I mean, we have so many great applications that, you know, the range of very good descriptors are, you know, how do you differentiate between exceptional and outstanding? Well, we're trying to differentiate between those and try to give descriptors for those. Like I said, the big changes to the applications just came through. One of the big changes is it used to be three separate sections for background and significance, research designs, and preliminary studies. They're now all combined into one section called the research strategy, which have these different components. What changing the structure did actually aligned the new application with the actual review criteria. So it's much easier for reviewers to find innovation because there's a section called innovation and you get to specifically state why this is an innovative project. Your approach you're going to be evaluated on, well, there's a whole section specifically on approach. So it's easier for them to find the components that they are supposed to review and evaluate. This was the big change for everybody, and I think where everybody had a lot of challenges is we went from 25-page applications to 12-page applications, and the applications that used to be 15 pages or 12 pages are now 6 pages. So you have to be able to communicate your message effectively in a way that people get the details that they need and understand the significance, innovation, and why your study will have big impact. The other changes that occurred is that the BioSketch now has a section where you should be adding specifically why your experience and qualifications make you well-suited to do this study. That means that your BioSketch should be different for every application that you submit. You can customize it for each individual application. They've also changed the number of publications, and they're recommending it to be no more than 15 publications on your BioSketch now. They've made a couple changes to the resources. I'm not going to go into these in big detail. They've now added a section that you have to describe the agents that you're using in terms of biocontainment resources at all of the sites. And ESIs have some the early stage investigators. You have to describe the institutional commitment. So who gets funded? This is the question that we always get asked. So how do we make decisions? Well, you, as I mentioned, every application gets a score, and the better the score, the higher the likelihood that you're going to get funded. But you also need to make sure that the application you're submitting is something that that institute or center is interested in. So what we always say again and again is call and speak to the program officer at the institute or center where you're applying and tell them what you're proposing. Is this something that's a fit with their institution? Is this something that they are interested in that's a priority for them? Because that is one of the things that determines what gets funded. You also need to take a look at what's already being funded by those institutes and centers to make sure that you're not duplicating work that's already being done. Research does need to be replicated, but you know, when are they going to do that replication and how many replications are really needed? So I'm going to show you the resource to be able to check for that. And then the challenge that we have, as I mentioned, is that we get so many great applications and yet we have a fixed budget. And so the pay lines are getting tighter, as we say at NIH. It's definitely, I think, for those of you out in the community are well aware that, you know, it used to be that they were funding at the, you know, 15th or 20th percentile. And, you know, now many institutes are funding at the 8th percentile. It's just the matter of the, you know, our budget's not increasing that much and we're getting more and more great applications. And so everything you can do to make your message really clear and why your research will have an impact will help the reviewers. So this is, for some of you, you may be more familiar with the CRISP database, which is what we had available. CRISP has been replaced by Reporter. And so the Reporter database now, which is, it's very easy to find if you just type in NIH Reporter. It should be one of the first ones that come up on any search engine that you take a look at. And there's much more information now available in the Reporter system. One of the things we're trying to do at the federal government is increase transparency. And so when you go in and find an individual project, it used to be that you would just get the abstract. Well, now in addition to the abstract, there's another link that shows you all of the data in terms of how many years of the award, how much money they had funded. It actually links to the publications. Every publication from the grant links back so that you can get to the publications. There's just a lot more information that's now available, and that's to try to make sure that everyone's aware that the research we fund and what are the implications and where things lead to. So wrapping up, I'm going to talk about some of our funding opportunities in terms of what we currently have available. I just want to make it clear, I get this call quite often, I want to go to acupuncture school, will NCAM pay for me to go to acupuncture school? No. The funding that we do for training is to fund researchers. And so we fund postdoctoral fellowships, we fund predoctoral fellowships, we fund career development awards, but we won't fund you to become a practitioner. And that's in general the case across most of NIH. There's a couple specific exceptions to that. But NCAM does not fund clinical training. There are a number of different training programs that we do offer. As I mentioned, the NRSA awards are fellowships, the pre and postdoctoral fellowships, career development awards. There are a number of different opportunities to increase diversity in the biomedical workforce. And I have a number of different handouts up here you can come up and grab afterwards that go through and give you more information about all of these. There is extramural loan repayment. For those, it is competitive. It's not automatic if you get funded. So that is something else that is available through NIH. So in addition to our training, we have this new funding opportunity called Preliminary Clinical Studies in Preparation for Large Interventional Trials and CAM Therapies. Two areas that I'll just briefly show here are probiotics and natural products for very specific conditions. But what I wanted to talk about a little bit more in detail, because I think it applies to this particular audience, are the mind-body approaches to promoting healthy eating, physical activity, adequate sleep, smoking cessation, and weight maintenance. The purpose of this, it's an R34 program, which is a planning grant is what it technically is at NIH. And it's a three-year award for up to $450,000. And the idea is that NCAM has learned that before we jump into large clinical trials, we really need to do the preliminary steps to make sure that we have the intervention down correctly before we jump into the large phase three clinical study. So this is a funding opportunity to do that preliminary work that's often needed. So sometimes there may need to be validation of a specific biomarker. You have a specific indicator, say heart rate variability for acupuncture or something like that, but you need to validate that that is a true measure of the outcome that you're interested in. And so this would potentially be an opportunity to do that. One of the things we always have a challenge with is, okay, so you tell people to practice yoga at home. Well, how are you measuring that adherence? Just self-report? Is there another way that you can measure adherence to your protocols? How are you actually going to measure that in a larger study so that we know how much yoga people actually did? Sometimes we're not sure which is the right outcome measure to assess, and so that is another possibility. And the other thing that we often struggle with is, what's the right comparison group? So what is the right group? And you need to understand your comparison group to be able to do your power calculation and determine your effect sizes. So that's another thing that can be done as part of this. And so there's many different examples. I'm the contact person for this particular funding opportunity. It's not for proof of concept. I've developed a new form of Qigong that I think is going to be beneficial. There's a different funding mechanism for that, the R21 funding mechanism. This is specifically for kind of, I've got some pretty good preliminary data, but before we launch that big study, I've got to figure out if this population will be able to do it, a feasibility study of some sort. We do partner with other institutes and centers. This is one where we partnered with NIDDK to look at diet composition and energy balance. NCAM's specifically interested in a few CAM approaches to changing energy balance, so omega-3 fatty acids, specific phytonutrients if you're interested in those. We're partnering with NHLBI on this one to look at nutrition and physical activity. Specifically for us, we're interested in meditation, yoga, or tai chi to improve different symptoms. Different dietary supplements that may impact atherosclerosis or COPD, and genetic or epigenetic determinants of responsiveness to different mind-body approaches. There's an Office of Behavioral and Social Sciences Research at NCAM, or at NIH as a whole, and we partner with them on a lot of different funding opportunities. This is one looking to reduce health disparities, and specifically in this one, we're looking for research on the health beliefs and practices of various health disparity populations. CAM instead of or in addition to conventional medical care. And I'm going to show you where you can find all of these in just a second, so don't feel like you've got to write all of these down. They're quite easy to find. I didn't want you to think that we're not still interested in the mechanisms of how things work, so the biology of manual therapies, we have a funding opportunity currently available both in an R01 and an R21. We also are signed on to the autism funding opportunity, which NIMH has issued. We're looking specifically at safety and efficacy of different CAM supplemental agents, but this is a really broad initiative across all different areas of autism. So where do you find this information if you didn't jot down the numbers and everything really quickly? Very easy to access on our website. So if you go to the grants tab there and clicked on the funding opportunities, you can do a search by a specific search term. You can run down the whole list of the 56 active program announcements that we currently have available. And linking on any one of those will take you to the funding opportunity announcement. One of the things that's changed at NIH is that you have to, any application you submit has to be in response to one of these funding opportunity announcements. You can't just blindly send in an application. To take into account the fact that there may not be a specific funding opportunity with your specific area of research, we've also signed on to the parent grants, which allow investigators to come in with any area of research that they want. So the R01 research project grant and the R21 exploratory developmental project grant. And those are all listed on here as well. If you want to look beyond NCAM, this is the NIH website, the grants.nih.gov, where there's another search box there that you can do a search term for any area of research that you're interested in, and it'll pull up any funding opportunity across the, I think, 700 or more funding opportunities that are currently available across all of NIH. And I'm gonna go ahead and pass the mic, I think, at this point to Isis, and we'll take questions, I think, at the end. So thank you.
Thank you. Fabulous. That was very informative. Our next speaker is Dr. Isis McHale. She's an MD, MPH, DRPH. She's the medical epidemiologist and is a medical epidemiologist and director of extramural research at the Office of Cancer, Complementary, and Alternative Medicine, OCCAM, at the National Cancer Institute. Her main role there is to help coordinate, support, and expand extramural cancer CAM research activities. Prior to joining OCAM in 2008, Dr. McHale was program director at the Division of Cancer Control and Population Sciences, where she oversaw a portfolio of cancer epidemiology grants and focused on rare cancers. Prior to joining NCI, she also was a researcher at the University of Alabama, Birmingham for approximately 15 years. So without any further ado, Dr. McHale.